This is a CBC podcast.
Hi, I'm Lisa Charlie Boy, also known as Urban Native Girl. I'm the host of New Fire. This summer, I'll introduce you to the next generation of Indigenous voices. From social media to sex, culture to ceremony, Indigenous young people share their stories and invite you into their communities. Subscribe to the podcast at cbc.ca/newfire on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Paul Kennedy. Welcome to Ideas.
Unless we question ourselves, unless we question the position we are in, we are not going to grow as a society. Because your mind becomes static, it becomes crippled, it becomes habit, you become like machines.
We live in a world where increasingly questioning ourselves isn't welcome. Everywhere there's been a spike in ultranationalism, hostility, and demonizing people who aren't like us. That's why we're presenting this special international series of five public talks we're calling Us and Them, Diversity, Division, and a World of Difference.
Now it's hot, but in the winter there are trees are flowering, the pots are flowering, it's indeed paradise. You don't find it in many parts of Delhi.
This episode takes us to India.
So you'll find that the buildings here, the houses here are very laid back. They are the old colonial style with gardens. So this is a part of Delhi that is the green lung of the city, we could say. Because everywhere else, builders have built concrete and glass monstrosities.
Neera Chandaki taught political science at the University of Delhi.
The whole of Lodi Garden is the green lung of Delhi.
It's comparatively calm and peaceful in the Lodi Gardens, or the Green Lung, as it's called in Delhi, although calm is obviously a relative term.
And in the morning, you find a lot of important persons with their bodyguards walking in the morning. And it's just...
Even here, it's impossible to ignore the constant honking of car horns and 24/7 traffic. But with a little effort, it's almost possible to imagine a place and a time for pure reflection.
Now, create understanding of what the culture of India is, open windows, wind blowing in. But kind of culture we are trying to maintain in the face of an increasingly claustrophobic society.
India is arguably the most complex and confusing society on the planet, with the world's second largest population and a centuries-long tradition of cultural preeminence, all fuel for perpetual political turmoil. This is a country that contains both grinding poverty and inconceivable wealth. Religious tensions are everywhere, all of which makes it a perfect place to talk about diversity and division in a world of difference.
I'm Neera Chandok. I have been an academic all my life, since the age of 21.
Neera recently retired from the University of Delhi, but she remains active in public life with her commitment to reshape the way India sees itself.
I have written widely on civil society, secularism, secession, and revolutionary violence. And currently I'm involved in a project which looks at the life and times of secularism. I'm kind of involved in redefining secularism for the age, because much of the West has given up on secularism, and in India it is the object of much ridicule. Let me put it this way. In a society where religion becomes a political project, making demands upon the state and becomes a state-making project, is secularism more or less important? Because how do you preserve diversity if religion is aligned with the state? What do you want us to do now?
You often hear that India is far and away the most populous democracy in the world. Something like 815 million people are eligible to vote. Outsiders can be forgiven for wondering how any government could possibly balance all the competing political, religious, and economic interests. But those are precisely the sort of problems that Neera Chandaki has pondered throughout her career. Now she's writing a book that she hopes will bring all of her thoughts together. And she brought those thoughts to a packed auditorium, including a sizable contingent of undergraduate students, at Jai Hind College in Mumbai. Her lecture is called Why India Needs Secularism.
Thank you. I'm extremely honored to be asked to give this talk. You know, India today is confronted by a question that is of immense importance to our collective lives. This question was first asked at the beginning of the 20th century, and we still do not seem to have found an answer. And the question very simply is, how does a society in which people belong to different religions and creeds, in where they speak different languages, and where they hold different conceptions of what we call the good, lives, lifestyles, beliefs, how do they manage to live together in some degree of civility, if not harmony? This is a very, very difficult question, and the answer has not been found, because to say that India is a plural society, and we know we are a plural society because almost all the world's major religions were born in India, and we have representatives of every religion who are Indian citizens and our fellow citizens. The proposition that India is plural does not automatically lead to the proposition that this plurality is of value, that we must protect it, we must safeguard it, we must look after it, we must cherish it. The first is an empirical proposition. It was a proposition, sociological proposition of how things are. The second is a normative proposition. It is a value-laden proposition that pluralism is of value. I'm not using the word multiculturalism, because multiculturalism came to us from China, which is from Canada, I beg your pardon, which is basically an immigrant society. We are historically plural. All the major religions in the world have grown up together, living together. We might have formed back-to-back communities, but we live, the concept of toleration became very important in India and for Indians. So we have to connect the two propositions, the empirical proposition that India is plural and the normative proposition that pluralism is of value, and how do we connect it? And I'm going to make three sorts of arguments which will enable us to connect these two propositions. See, in political life, there are no very safe roads or easy roads. You have to think, you have to reflect, you have to consider, you have to argue, you have to debate, and you have to do it in community. That is why cherish your college days, because this is the time that you will be able to exchange ideas, and unless you exchange ideas, you are not able to grow as a human being. So what are conceivably the three reasons that we can think of to say pluralism is a value, as distinct from the proposition that India is plural? The first kind of argument I would suggest is purely instrumental. Consider this. We have a very elaborate system of fundamental rights in our constitution. We have signed the UN Charter of Human Rights. We subscribe to every right that is on offer, and literally social activists discover a right a day. In fact, most historical claims on the state are now couched as rights, and political theorists are scratching their heads to find out why is this a right? But that is a different story. What happens in situations when a person is humiliated or damaged or bodily integrity violated or killed just because he or she happens to be a member of a different religious community? She has committed no harm, she has broken no law, she has violated nothing. Just by being a member of a community that has been stereotyped either as the other or as the enemy, she's subjected to bodily harm and she is subjected to murder. Only because she belongs to a group that has been stereotyped in perverse ways. Is not the right of a group to respect an essential precondition of individual rights? I'd like to ask you to consider it. Yes, my right as a Hindu, as a Muslim, as a Parsi, as Christian, as a member of the Jewish community is important. We should value people not despite they belong to a religious community, but because they belong to a religious community. We have to learn to respect communities because these community value systems are preconditioned for individual rights. We know it. Even you growing up will know this. The second reason is a sociological reason. See, we are human because we learn to speak a language. Where do we get that language from? We get that language from our community. We move on, we become members of other associations. We even might forget our original language. But somehow our meaning systems, our values in life are conditioned by our community. You know, Gandhi has an interesting story. He said, I read the English translation of the Bhagavad Gita, which was done by Edwin Arnold. The period of Orientalism at the beginning of the 19th century was a period when European Indologists and what came to be known as Orientalists began to translate the Sanskrit texts, the Vedas. But he says, my first familiarity, says Gandhi, with the Bhagavad Gita was on my mother's knee. Now, his mother was a Jain, and Jains have no concept of God, of the divine. They're a materialist philosophy like the Charvaks. He says, I learnt the Bhagavad Gita on my mother's knee, but the more critical notions, aspects of the Bhagavad Gita I learned. But look at Gandhi's mind. He can move from a folk tale he heard as a child from his mother to a very sophisticated translation of the Bhagavad Gita by the Indologist Edwin Arnold. That movement between different cultures, different languages, makes us human. And that brings me to the third point. And the third point is simply this. To live in a society where everybody believes in the same God, speaks the same language, has the same idea of what to eat and what not to eat, what to drink and what not to drink, is a monochromatic society. And a monochromatic society is the most boring society I can imagine. Imagine living in a culture where everybody does exactly what you do, or you do what everybody does. And that imposition of cultural codes and what we should eat and what we should drink is actually repugnant to our status as mature human beings who know what we want to do with our lives, who to be friends with, who to love, who to marry, what schools our children should go to, what we want on our dining table, what we want to drink. No, we don't want groups of vigilantes coming and telling us and engaging in the most horrendous crimes India has seen because they think two young people should not be together in a park if they don't go somewhere to provide places for them to go to. I mean, what is youth if you're not in love? And to be targeted because you're just with a man or with another, or a man is with a woman, or even same sex, how does it matter? Two people love each other, who is a third party to tell them? We know who we have to love, right? It's a personal decision.
Neera Chandoki, talking to a standing room only audience in Mumbai. A few days later, I had a chance to interview her in New Delhi, where she lives. She explained how even a mundane act like eating can reveal fascinating and fundamental truths.
The problem of eating and the problem of particularly when it comes to young people getting married, is very acute in India. And if you look at the communal issue, the Hindu-Muslim problem in terms of caste, because upper caste Hindus will not only not eat with the Muslim, they will not eat with somebody of another caste. And if it comes to marriage, even the most progressive families can go berserk if their children want to marry out of the community. Now, in a way, the moment you accept that, okay, we may not eat out of the same plate as, you know, on Friday, if you go to Jama Masjid, that ancient mosque in Old Delhi, it's a very moving spectacle because a lot of cards come from embassies from the Arab world, and they give food to the poor, and they all eat out of a common plate. Now, and this happens, I think, in Mediterranean restaurants, you get a platter of food and you eat. But this issue of purity and pollution that has bedeviled upper caste Hinduism prevents them from recognizing other people as equal. Nehru once wrote in his Discovery of India, the Hindu will die observing the rules of his kitchen. What to eat, what not to eat, who to eat with. I mean, he just keeps observing the rules of his kitchen. Then Nehru goes on to say, Islam is a little better, but even they have forgotten their original egalitarianism, because there's also caste in Islam and in Christianity and in Sikhs. So there is a very peculiar South Asian version of religion, where religions are defined more by their language and the region they come from. You know, there is no such thing in India, because you will find Muslims in Tamil Nadu having very little to do with Muslims in North India. They speak different languages, they have different mythologies. So in a way, you know, South Asia is a region of fluidity. The worrying part is that now Wahhabi Islam has made its appearance onto a religion that was necessarily very, what they call, fuzzy boundaries, what anthropologists call fuzzy boundaries. And identities are hardening. Otherwise, their music is so much. Whenever I've been to Pakistan, though I was born after partition, I always feel I've come home, because, you know, that was the land of my grandfather. And the first time they asked me, how do you feel? I said, I feel I've come home. The same language, the same customs, the same folk music, the same ways of worshipping. What is the difference between us, except our religion? So to keep religion apart, to make religion keep people apart, I think is criminal.
India has been something of a textbook example of diversity virtually from the beginning of recorded history, which, by the way, some experts would argue was actually an Indian invention. Emerging from a welter of independent states and kingdoms, with a history of invasions and empires, India probably came closest to some semblance of unity during the 20th century under British colonial rule. Ironically, or maybe not, much, if not most, of this newfound sense of solidarity was created by a common desire to kick the British out. Pakistan, with a Muslim majority, was partitioned from India in 1947 and went its own way. But there are still at least 100 million Muslims living in India, as well as hundreds of other religions. There are also countless ethnic groups, speaking more than 1,600 languages, although only 150 of those languages boast a substantial speaking population. As for official languages, want to guess? India has 22 official languages, in addition to English. And then there's the complexity of the still-powerful caste system. Pundits have often seen such deafening diversity as a fatal flaw, or something close to it. For Neera Chandaki, it's an underappreciated asset.
That exposure to different languages, that exposure to different cuisines, that exposure to different sorts of belief systems is what makes a society valuable. Each day is a journey of adventure. You know, consider this, and I've always laughed about it. In a Bollywood film, two young people talk in Hindi, but normally they speak more in English these days. But when they sing in Urdu. I mean, Urdu is the language of love. And particularly if the lyrics are written by Javed Akhtar or by Gulzar. Suddenly they switch to Urdu, but perfectly American accented speaking English heroine or hero starts singing in Urdu. Now that is an indication of the richness of our culture. You can slide between languages. There is a certain variety to our life. So in a way, I think diversity is important because it makes a society creative. It makes our society live. It makes it vibrant. Yes, it makes it worth living. Now, these are the three reasons I've outlined for you why minority rights, particularly of minorities, because they're always at risk. See, in politics, you have two kinds of majorities and minorities. One are electoral. This time, your candidate hasn't won. Next time, he or she might win. These are flexible. But some people are minorities because they are born into a community which is not only demographically smaller than the majority, but whose culture and whose symbols are not reflected in the public sphere. That is called a minority. And it is important to safeguard them. it is important to safeguard them because we learn. You know, I was brought up in a Catholic convent, and most people of my generation were. And we were taught Christianity, the values of Christ. I think it made us richer human beings. I learned from my Islamic friends how to share. Hindus don't share their plates with other people. They're always worried they might belong to another caste. But here you have a notion of communal eating, which is so important for us to become fuller human beings. They do not disregard another person because of his caste or her gender or her religion. So in a way, you have to link the proposition that we are a plural society and pluralism is of value by some concept. And what concept can this be except secularism? Now, yours is a generation that has grown up when secularism no longer seems to be important in political life. But secularism is important because, remember, the opposite of secularism is not communalism. The opposite of secularism is theocracy, when the state and religion are welded together. You know, if your people are on Netflix, and I'm sure most young people are, nobody watches TV, I think, not even I these days, watch a Netflix drama series called The Tudors. It's about Henry VIII and his six wives, but more importantly, it's about the clash between Catholics and the Reformists, who became the Protestants. Killing each other, burning each other on the issue of religion was the issue then. And then you realize, what kind of a religion do we belong to if we practice violence on another?
At the beginning of her lecture, Neera Chandiki pointed out that many of the world's great religions actually got their start in India. During our follow-up interview, she told me how she believes this ecumenical diversity, while it's been a source of tension and conflict, is actually a great thing.
I'm happy that India is multi-religious in the sense that I think we can learn from each other. A lot of these religions were breakaways from Hinduism. They were protests against Hinduism. So whether it was Sikhism or Jainism or Buddhism, these were protest movements which formed a separate religion. In the constitution, interestingly, all these three religions have come to be a subset of Hinduism, which is not a very healthy proposition, politically speaking. Because these were protest movements, they brought out the iniquities of the Brahmanical order. They were anti-hierarchy, anti-caste, anti-egalitarian stems in Hinduism. Christianity comes to us in the form of Syrian Christianity, which is, of course, Thomas who came and converted a whole range of people to Christianity. So it's a very interesting take on Christianity, because if you look at the churches now, they're full of Hindu hymns and their modes of worship are very different from what you would find in a Catholic church anywhere else in the world. So it's interesting that religion in a way gives you identity, but this great overarching fluid nature of Hinduism has managed to incorporate all of them to a point where now it is said that Gautam Buddha, the founder of Buddhism, was actually a manifestation of the divine in Hinduism. And I think that's a pity, because we have to keep protest at the center of our study of religions. Islam brought with it a very different culture. You know, an architect friend once told me that if you look at the domes on the temples, which enclose the sanctum sanctorum, they come from the Uzbekistan tent, because that is how it's come from Central Asia, because of the way tents have been organized. So it is a syncretic culture. It is a culture that has incorporated the best of everything, and particularly in poetry, in art, in literature, in architecture. The panels you must have seen at the Taj Mahal, for instance, they are being replicated in all the hotels, in saris, in clothing, the Mughal miniatures. So if we have a great heritage, we must know how to preserve the diversity of that heritage.
I'm Paul Kennedy, and you're listening to Ideas on CBC Radio 1, Sirius XM, and cbc.ca. Today's program features Indian thinker Neera Chandaki as part of our five-part international series called Us and Them, Diversity, Division, and a World of Difference. The series is produced in partnership with the Laurier Institution in Vancouver. Neera Chandaki believes that India enjoys an almost endless inventory of assets that make the country rich beyond belief, despite the obvious and overwhelming poverty that is equally real. Diversity was recognized and appreciated from the very beginning by Indian storytellers, artists, thinkers, and writers. That glorious past is a prologue to the present, as well as a passport to a potential future that's just as glorious.
There's a very interesting story in the Mahabharata. There was a sage called Kosaka, and this sage was meditating under a tree, and a crow caught above him on the tree branch and broke his meditation. So he looked at the crow, and you know these sannyasis had great power to shrivel anybody with the force of their gaze. He looked at the crow, and the crow shriveled to death. And Kosaka was in confusion. I mean, he said, what have I done? Because remember, if there is one value which has been privileged in Hindu text, it's that of ahimsa, of nonviolence. Ahimsa in the Vedas is a part of individual virtue. You know, if you are a good human being, you practice ahimsa in thought, in word, in deed. After the Mahabharata war, well, you know, generations died in these 13 days of killing. Yudhishthir, who is victorious and who always was a Hamlet-like figure walking around saying, should I or should I not? So after he won the war, he says, I can't govern. What have I done? I've killed nieces, nephews, my own children have died. This is terrible. I don't want to govern it. So Krishna said, go and speak to Bhishma, who's still lying on his bed of arrows. And he asked Bhishma, what are the qualities of a ruler? And Bhishma outlines the three qualities of it. The third quality is ahimsa. So ahimsa is a value. And think of the creativity. When Gandhi looks at ahimsa, ahimsa is the property of social struggles against power. So from an individual virtue, it becomes a political virtue of resistance. This is the kind of creativity you find in our ethics if you look at them intelligently enough and in a creative fashion. It's not enough to say, Garav se kaho hum Hindu hai. Understand what Hinduism means. Hinduism means innovation. So this sage Kosaka, who had been brought up in a tradition of ahimsa, finds he has killed a crow. So he says, I obviously have not learnt enough. He walks around searching for the truth, and he comes to a household. And in that household, there's a woman who invites him in. But then he finds that she's serving her husband before she serves him. And he says, what do you mean? Don't you know who I am? I'm the great sage Kosaka. And she says, yes, but I'm not a crow who you will shrivel with the force of your vision. Now remember, at that time and even till today, women are not supposed to be repositories of wisdom, right? Women are supposed to perform roles, whether that of looking pretty or whether that of being a good housewife or a homemaker, right? But here is a woman who is a homemaker who tells Kosaka she has a power of cognition. She knows he has killed a crow, and he says, my God, how do you know that? And she says, I even know you're looking for wisdom. If you really want to know what wisdom is, go to that butcher. He'll tell you. He goes to the shed of a butcher, and in a slaughterhouse, which is being closed these days by the vigilantes in our country, attended with great violence, he learns the meaning of ahimsa from a low-caste butcher. Now, understand the implications of what I'm telling you, the story, just not a story. You know, Mahabharata was collated, condensed over hundreds of years. epics here, epics there. Shakuntala is a pre-Mahabharat story. She was a tribal woman. By the time Kalidasa writes about Shakuntala, she's a weepy woman asking, pleading for her rights. But originally, she's a tribal woman who fights for her rights. But here you have a sage, who's obviously Brahmin, learning from a woman who was not considered to be wise enough, and learning from a butcher what life is. And life is non-violence. Hinduism means non-violence. It doesn't mean you practice violence in the name of safeguarding some kind of Hindu ethos that has been created by yourself. If you look at vigilantes, they are legislators, they lay down what the rule is. They are the prosecutors, they tell you what somebody has done wrong. They are the judge, they are the jury, and they are the executioners. Now, in a democracy, where you have separation of powers, do you have room for such groups? Day before yesterday, they barged into a home in Meerut and right into a bedroom. Do we want that happening to us? Because the right of privacy is the first right that comes up as part of civil rights. So in a way, if you have to be a Hindu, an Indian citizen, you have to practice the virtue of toleration. Now, toleration is very different from tolerance. Tolerance means you tolerate somebody even if you don't like them. Toleration is a political theory concept. Where does it come from? It comes from Gandhi. But more importantly, Gandhi, remember, had translated Plato's Apology into Gujarati. Now, Plato's Apology is about the death of Socrates, who was condemned to drink hemlock. The jury, Athenian jury, asked Socrates, why do you go around corrupting the morals of young men, talking to this person, talking to that person, stopping people on the street? The word of rhetoric comes to us from ancient Greek, that you attain wisdom when you start asking questions. Remember, you people are young. You have your whole life to live out. A society only thrives when it begins to ask questions. And just not read life as a series of newspaper headlines. I know watching television cripples our minds. Given the kind of anchors we have, they scream more than the participants. Think about it, right? Reflect. So Socrates has one very interesting answer, and this is why I'm concentrating on this story, because I want you to understand. You know, I'm a political scientist. I've taught political theory all my life. But I've always taught it through literature and epics. Now think of the story of Socrates. Socrates says, a friend of mine went to the oracle at Delphi in Greece, and she always told the truth, this oracle, who nobody saw. Kind of a divine person. And that friend asked her, who is the wisest man in Greece? And she said, Socrates. So Socrates' friend comes and tells him, the oracle at Delphi has said, you're the wisest man in Greece, Socrates. I knew she was wrong. I knew I don't know enough. So he said, I started talking to people, catching them by the collar on the street. They were philosophers, they were dramatists, they were scientists. I mean, Greece had them all, because Greeks had one virtue, which they lost in the 1,000 years of dark ages, the virtue to ask questions. And Socrates comes back and says, you know, I knew maybe I'm wiser than them. You know why? They don't even know they don't know. I know I don't know.
Neera, as you've likely noticed, has a supple and surprising mind. For example, she's a political scientist, but she doesn't put much stock in politicians. She turns instead to classical epics from antiquity.
If you look at epics, Greek epics, or even the Indian epics, the Mahabharata, for instance, you come to realize that the human condition is too complex to be solved by one man. And this is exactly the sentiment that pervaded when they voted either for the Prime Minister or for the Chief Minister of Delhi. That one man is going to solve all up. It doesn't happen. You see, there are no easy solutions to the human condition. And this you have to understand. You're going to live in dilemmas, with dilemmas. And you better accept it. There's a philosopher called Bimal Mathilal in India. He's no more. Indian philosopher who actually lived at Oxford. He said it doesn't mean that if you're faced with a dilemma, you become helpless. You use innovation, you use inventiveness, and you figure out. Because politics doesn't offer easy solutions. Those days are over.
Neera has more time for ideas and ideals than she does for political actors. Ideals like toleration.
Well, toleration is a more positive concept in political theory, which says you should tolerate people because they have good reasons for doing what they wish to do. Tolerance is, I don't like you, but I will still tolerate you. Toleration would be actually a positive attitude in saying, I don't agree with you, but you have very good reasons for doing what you want to do. So I respect you for that. And there are many way things I cannot understand. It is basically based upon an epistemological lack. I don't have knowledge, so I cannot judge you. Tolerance, you just bear up with someone because you think that, okay, that's an easier way of being than any other thing. John Locke writes an essay on toleration. It's available on the internet. Yes? And he says at the time there's civil war in England, breaking out again over Church of England, breaking away from the Catholic Church at Rome. And he says only one thing, tolerate people's religion. Tolerate it because you do not know why they believe the way they do. You know, my relationship to God is a personal transaction between me and my God. I don't know why you believe the way you do. How can we understand, if we are not a Parsi, why Parsi throw their dead out to be eaten at by the birds? You have to be a Parsi and understand the sublimity that after you're dead, that's it. It's finished. You know, you have to, people you cannot understand. If you cannot understand why people believe the way they do, you cannot be intolerant. You cannot practice violence. Nobody can be sure, and Gandhi said exactly the same thing in his notion of Ahimsa. I do not know whether I know the truth. I can never know. Yes? I can never know the truth. All religions teach the truth, but all religions are still searching for the truth. See, if we have found truth, we've become God. What is divinity? You find yourself at one with God, with the Brahman, with your inner. If I have found it, I'm above all of you, but we are all human beings. We are fallible, our knowledge is imperfect, and unless you know you're only a seeker after knowledge, you can never be arrogant. And out of arrogance comes violence. Why are you killing people because they don't belong to a religion that you belong to? Why are you humiliating them? You don't know. That is why secularism is important. See, there are two kinds of divides in society. Please learn to distinguish them. One is a vertical divide. India, Hindu society is divided along the axis of caste. I'm standing in Mumbai, the home of Ambedkar. The home of Ambedkarites. And the reason why the Dalit issue becomes so important in Indian politics because of Ambedkar. Yes, but that is a matter for democracy, a matter for our constitution. Why is it a matter for secularism? Secularism deals with horizontal divisions, that Indian society is composed of Hindus, Muslims, Sikhs, Parsis, Christians. And of course, within Hinduism, you have so many cults. You can't even keep pace. There's a cult every day. Every godman has his own cult. Or a godwoman, for that matter. There's a godwoman who lives in Bombay. I saw her on television. She looks like a Punjabi bride. And people worship her. I forget what her name is or what she does. But, I mean, she looks like a Punjabi bride. How can anybody worship? I mean, Hindus have worshipped stones and worshipped trees and worshipped the atmosphere. The great German philosopher Hegel, 1820, he becomes a professor of philosophy in Berlin University. He says philosophy begins from India. India is the cradle of philosophy. Of course, after it migrates to Greece, he says India degenerates. It's ripe for conquest. You know, but that is our tradition. A tradition of valuing you do not know. There are limits to knowledge. So secularism has to be part of a process of valuing others because they know what their truth is. I know what my truth is. Let me follow my path. Let them follow their path. You need not interdine. You need not intermarry. You need not be friends. You can't force people to be friends with anybody, but at least don't kill each other. Don't injure them. Don't humiliate them. Your humanity is diminished and their humanity is diminished. And in the process, we are diminished as a society.
Just before we arrived in India, there'd been a spate of Hindu nationalists attacking non-Hindus. They'd stopped trucks and accused drivers of the crime, which is not actually a crime, of transporting cows, which are, of course, sacred animals for Hindus. And it got a lot worse, with beatings, riots, and even killings. Some say the ruling Hindu nationalist party, the BJP, actually encourages the vigilantes, who are enabled by a basically passive press and an aggressively mindless social media.
I think we've taken a distinctive step backwards. We have become an extremely intolerant society. And not only that, it's legitimized. We are a society that doesn't hesitate to make its prejudices and its anger evident. It happens in social media. You just have to look at the social media. And it is a society that's first forgotten the great questions of the human condition. The question which your program is raising, how to value diversity. But this glorification of force, of coercion, of Pakistan as the enemy, of Muslims as somebody who have actually become irrelevant in Indian society. You leave the task to vigilantes to terrify them into subservience. It is very troublesome. And more troublesome is the fact that we have stopped speaking up. You look at the reaction to Donald Trump, and you look at India where the media has been sold out. You find perfectly well-educated corporate guys saying things that you never thought you'd ever hear in my childhood. I never heard all these things. It's taken a big step backwards. And most of all, I think what the current government has done is to cripple our ability to reflect, consider, and question. And that is the beginning of a degradation of a society.
Is there any optimism in that context?
There is no optimism. And there's no optimism anywhere in the world, perhaps Canada, because you're such a civilized society. I mean, this friend from Britain who is a professor, a very well-known scholar, she said, you know, where is the optimism? The trade unions have collapsed. Left parties are in disarray. In India, civil society is being curbed relentlessly. You know, that their entire ability to work in a space to articulate dissent or to link up with social movements has been crippled. The political system is in disarray. You have one man, one party ruling everything. And it happens whenever I speak to younger people, and that's why Bombay was so refreshing. Why are you an admirer of Nehru and why are you not an admirer of the chief minister, of the present prime minister? Nehru had a vision. You see, the question that faces society are not only how much you will grow or how much you will digitalize. It's a basic question of how we live together. So that is why I'm really appreciative of this whole program to bring diversity to the forefront of political discourse. It's important because you must value individuals for what they are, not despite what they are. I don't think societies grow if they are not diverse. In a way, we have to consider, reflect, that secularism is a part of democracy. What did Nehru say in 1948? You know, secularism was never discussed, never defined, even in the Constituent Assembly. In 48, Nehru says, secularism doesn't mean that I am not religious. Everybody has a right to their religion. Everybody has a right not to be religious. What is freedom? The right to do, the right not to do. If I don't want to be religious, nobody can force me. Then I'm free. But he says it means three things. It means freedom, equality. The state shall not be aligned to any religion. Now, freedom, equality is covered by democracy. Yes. The secular principle is the state shall not be aligned to any religion, which by that virtue becomes the state religion. Because that is the cause of hundreds of years of civil war in Europe. And it is the cause of our present unrest and our strife. Yes. In a way, Nehru sets the stage because secularism is defined by the Supreme Court. Interestingly, our Supreme Court has carried on two projects. They carry on the colonial project of defining Hinduism. So defining religion, that is a colonial project, and reforming religion is a nationalist project. From Raja Ram Mohan Roy till Gandhi, they all tried to reform us. They probably failed. Yes, we still practice caste, we still practice communalism, we still practice child marriages, we still practice gender injustice. What have we learned from our own history? I wonder. Secularism is meant to safeguard that aspect of democracy which deals with a plural society. It deals with horizontal. You know, we should not overload secularism. We overloaded it. We tried to make it an alibi for national integration. We tried to solve the personal law problem. You look at the court, whenever it has pronounced on personal law of the Muslim, they'll say personal law, secularism, national integration. Secularism has nothing to do with the position of women. Democracy does. And please remember when women were fighting a battle in Bombay to enter the Haji Ali or to enter the Shani Temple, they invoked two articles of the fundamental right. Article 14, the right to equality. Article 19, the right to freedom. So let us not overstress secularism. It is a thin concept. It supports democracy. Yes? That notion of democracy says, which says, you shall not be discriminated against merely because you belong to a minority community. To violate secularism is to violate democracy. I'll end here. Thank you.
Neera Chandaki at Jai Hind College in Mumbai. A couple of days after that lecture, Neera and I got together again in New Delhi, where she lives, to record an interview about her work. There's a video of that interview and her lecture, which you can see on our website, cbc.ca/ideas. Neera and I met at the Indian International Center, where she does most of her research and writing. After I'd asked all the questions on my list, she took me on a short walk in the garden. A very short walk. It was something like 48 degrees Celsius. But almost instantly, we came across something totally by chance that had an uncanny relevance for what we'd just been talking about. Tucked away in the garden was a memorial to Mahatma Gandhi and Martin Luther King.
So Gandhi's notion of equality, which inspired Martin Luther King, was the theme for this plaza. You know, Gandhi was someone who was deeply disturbed at the hierarchy of Hindu society. And when he had his debate with the prominent leader of the former Untouchables, Dr. Ambedkar, he said to him, look, untouchability is not only a problem of you guys, it's also a problem of the Hindu community. It should examine and investigate why we sanction such inhuman treatment to people who just have been born in a low caste family or born out of caste. He was not moved by modern notions of equality, and he was not moved by modern notions of rights, because he thought that makes for a isolated individual and atomized society, and he stressed great deal upon the obligation of each individual to his community or her community and her society. So the notion of equality, which has moved revolutions, at least to the Soviet Union and China, can move people to change their attitudes to the way they treat an entire section of our own people, who of course have now stood up and spoken back to history. And the founders of modern India were very committed to the eradication of inequality, because it caste inequality, because they thought that was essential for building a modern liberal democracy.
Ideas, you've been listening to Neera Chandaki, our featured speaker in India. Her lecture is called Why India Needs Secularism, and it was delivered at the Jai Hind College in Mumbai. It's part of our international series called Us and Them, Diversity, Division, and a World of Difference. The series is produced by Ideas in partnership with the Laurier Institution. This episode was produced by Lisa Godfrey, Dave Riddell, and Greg Kelly. You can let us know your thoughts about this episode or any other on our webpage, cbc.ca/ideas, where you can always get our podcast and see videos of each of our Us and Them speakers. You can also live stream every Ideas program on the Radio Player Canada app. The music for Us and Them was composed especially for the series by Virginia Kilbertus. Audio and video production, James Cooper. Additional production, Dave Field. Liz Nagy is our associate producer, and the executive producer of Ideas is Greg Kelly. I'm Paul Kennedy.
It strikes me that if people are left alone to live their own lives, and a good dose of liberal theory is what our rulers need, you will find philosophers saying that in pre-modern India, people didn't kill each other over religion. They lived back to back. But they were not killing each other the way they are today. See, today we are in a competitive society, a market society in political competitiveness, and that leads to unrest. Now, the transition from having communal sentiments to communal riots happens when there is a trigger. And this trigger is provided by the fundamentalists, by people of all religions. Your generation is much more aware than my generation was. So in a way, if India has to become a nation, it'll become a nation because of two factors: Bollywood and cricket. Or increasingly soccer. Yes, your generation, I think, is more in soccer. We're all Indians. What's the problem? Rabindranath Tagore, and I'll end with that. Rabindranath Tagore, you know, in that famous book and movie, Ghare Baire, The Home and the World, Nikhil, who is played by Viktor Banerjee, says, "Of course I don't love my country. To worship one's country like a god is to bring a curse upon it."
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.